The Blaze Radio Network. On demand.
Love. Courage. Truth.
There is nothing permanent except change. It's a force that can't be stopped. Status quo people, status quo businesses are going to be left in the dust. Some businesses are going to get this. Some businesses are going to lead the way. Others are going to fall by the wayside because they don't get it, or they're resistant, or they think that it's not going to be as big as everybody thinks it is. There was a story in the Wall Street Journal yesterday. The department store Nordstrom's is opening up a new store called Nordstrom Local. It's an experiment. It's kind of a hybrid between online retail and the traditional department store. Now, I grew up in the Pacific Northwest. I grew up in the Seattle area. Nordstrom's was the store. They've done it right for, I don't even know, 100 years. Nordstrom Local is going to be much smaller. They're going to have personal style consultants, a meeting area with a bar, areas to try on merchandise, curbside pickup for online purchases. The one thing they're not going to carry? Clothes. Wait, isn't Nordstrom's a clothing store? Here's the thing. Nordstrom realizes that the malls are dying. People like to shop online. But that doesn't mean that shopping in person is dead. Nordstrom's is going to try something different. They want to give people what they want: personal service, speed, convenience. I read an article yesterday that said, you know, it may not work. It's a total gamble. But they know that what they're currently doing is not the future. They know that they have to try something because a department store is a thing of the past. And if you don't believe me, ask Sears or JCPenney. The reason why I bring this up is it's not just stores. The status quo is not working. It's not working for the TV networks. It's not working for the movie business. It's not going to be working for trucking. It's not going to be working for schools. It's already not working. And the more we try to hold on to the university system, the worse our pain is going to get. The old models are being turned upside down. It's not working in Washington. It's not Barack Obama's fault, and it's not Donald Trump's fault. The world is changing. The D.C. swamp that President Trump wants to drain is much more of a tar pit. Republicans and Democrats are content right now with where they are, who they are, because they don't think they have to change. But in a free market system, you do have to change. You have a problem with the status quo when Chuck Schumer and Lindsey Graham are your party's flag bearers. Yesterday, I was reading that Lindsey Graham is now leading the charge on change. Lindsey Graham? This is status quo thinking. That is part of the reason Donald Trump became president. But soon, the political version of Nordstrom's Local will appear. I don't know where, but it is not necessarily going to be shiny, but it is going to be innovative. And a lot of people will like it. When you have Schumer and Lindsey Graham being flag bearers, they are not flag bearers. Those are pole bearers. When something new does appear, if it is truly from the free market, it will be better. Because when it's truly from the people, when it is ground up, it will be anchored in America's founding principles, because we know those principles actually work.
It's Tuesday, September 12th. This is the Glenn Beck Program.
It was on 9/12 that John F. Kennedy said, "We choose to go to the moon and do those other things, not because they're easy, but because they are hard." This is the America that we have always known. Oh, I don't know what it is about this date, 9/12, but it's 9/12. And there is something about this date that stirs America into action. It was the day after 9/11 that things changed, at least for me. On 9/11, I was scared and freaked out of my mind. On 9/12, I began to think, there's hope. And I began to think that because of the people that just rose up. The average person in America that had nothing to do with politics or companies or anything else. Just my neighbors gave me hope. The same thing that we're seeing now in Houston. And the same things that we're seeing in Florida. Yesterday, I was on my way home, and I heard a piece of audio. Somebody sent this to me, and it is the Hymn to the Innocent. And it's done by a high school philharmonic. These kids that are playing in this philharmonic and this choir, none of them were born on 9/11. None of them were alive. The only America that these kids know is the America that has guards at the airport. The America that is at war. Been at war their whole life. When you and I were wondering whether America was going to survive, every member of this Philharmonic was not alive. And look at what they're creating. As you wonder about the next generation, as you wonder about even our school system, here is an amazing school called the American Heritage School. That honestly, if I didn't own movie studios in Texas, I would move my family so my kids could go to school there. Yesterday, as I was driving home and I was listening to this, I thought back on a conversation I had with a coworker. He was in eighth grade when the towers came down. He said, "I feel different today." He said, "I kind of feel bad. It's weird." He said, "This is the first year that it feels like that happened a long time ago. And I kind of feel the same way. It feels like it happened a long time ago." Why? Last year it didn't feel like that. The year before it didn't feel like that. What's changed? May I suggest that one thing has changed? The fundamental transformation of America. During the Barack Obama administration, he said, "We're just 3 days away from the fundamental transformation of America." And nobody heard it. We did. Those of us on the right, we heard it. The left dismissed it. But we heard it and we thought, boy, you restore something of value. You don't go in and look at the Mona Lisa and say, "You know, I'm going to have a fundamental transformation of that Mona Lisa thing." You look at the Mona Lisa and say, "Is there a way to restore this? Is there a way to bring it back to its original vibrance? We knew it was changing. The left caught up with that during the last election and said, what's going on? How can this be? Hillary Clinton is still saying, how could this be? And I told you this summer that we were at the end of the beginning, and we now were at the beginning of the middle. That the fundamental transformation of America has happened. But it is only in our systems. As I said a minute ago, business is changing. Television news is changing. Politics is changing. What we would have never accepted before, ever, we now embrace. We don't tolerate. We embrace it. Policies, principles, culture, business, finances, everything is new and unstable. Except for one thing. We haven't been fundamentally transformed yet. They're still working on that. And when I say they, I don't mean some, you know, star chamber, deep dark secrets. I mean, what we're going through right now, the collective, it hasn't changed us yet. There still is that 9-12 person inside each of us.
I'm on Glenn's Facebook page. You can listen to this. It's Hymn to the Innocent by an a high school philharmonic.
It's crazy, isn't it?
Amazing. At the American Heritage School. You can look at it on Glenn's Facebook page. It's the post where she mentions Furtwängler. That's how you can find it. Just search for the word Furtwängler on his Facebook page.
Normal people doing amazing things. That's really what America is all about. Normal people doing amazing things. There is one story about 9/11 that I have only heard in bits and pieces, but there's a new documentary out, The Untold Tale of the 9/11 Resilience. Here's a clip.
They showed me, you know, when the American people need to come together and pull together, they will do it.
I do feel a way honored that I was a part of it.
It was the greatest thing I ever did with my life.
The greatest day that I've ever seen in all my boating, I mean, my life on the water.
I believe somebody has a little hero in them. You gotta look in. And it's in there. It'll come out. If need to be.
I have one theory in life. I never want to say the word I should have. If I do it and I fail, I tried. If I do it and I succeed, better for me. And I tell my children the same thing. Never go through life saying you should have. If you want to do something, you do it.
This is an amazing documentary because that, what he just said, is the American spirit. If that is ever snuffed, then we are done. But never say, I should have. Do it. If you fail, you fail. But almost everything in our society, at least from the old system, is trying to stop us from doing that. Stop you from thinking that you have the power to change politics. Stop you from thinking that you could pull away from the Democrats or the Republicans. Stop you from believing that you have an idea that is worth something so you can start your own business. You can just go out on your own. Although technology and the way the world is moving is telling you a different story. And it is a story that is... it is the story of the West. We're not a collective. We are individuals. And in our greatest hours, we don't come together and as a collective, because we've been told, we come together as individuals privately, and then what we do is multiplied by all these other people who have the same drive, the same feeling. It is the Adam Smith invisible hand. And that invisible hand was evident on 9/11. So many miraculous things happened. But the one we don't know is how the actual U.S. Navy behaved. And I don't mean the one that have the big gray ships. I mean the citizens' Navy, the citizens' brigade. It wasn't the ferries that brought everybody across the water on 9/11. They were citizens. Here's Tom Hanks.
The great boat lift of 9/11 became the largest sea evacuation in history. Larger than the evacuation of Dunkirk in World War II, where 339,000 British and French soldiers were rescued over the course of 9 days. On 9/11, nearly 500,000 civilians were rescued from Manhattan by boat. It took less than 9 hours.
It's an amazing story, well worth your 12 minutes on YouTube today. It's called Boat Lift, An Untold Tale of 9/11 Resilience. It's narrated by Tom Hanks and put out by the Center for National Policy. We just tweeted it from @WorldOfStew. You can link to it there.
Children born on 9/11 are now old enough to get their driver's license. That blows my mind. You were born on 9/11. Yesterday, you could officially get your driver's license. The world has changed. It always does. But some things remain the same. And that is, there's a next generation that believes, there's a next generation right behind us that isn't tired and feeling worn out. They're ready. Another thing that changes is our need for emergency preparedness. Our friends in Houston, our friends in Florida know this, coming face to face with hurricanes. I trust my Patriot Supply, our sponsor, for my food storage. Right now they have 70 servings of survival food for only $67, less than a dollar per serving. That's breakfast, lunch, and dinner. Healthy food that lasts for 25 years. You know, the survival food thing hasn't changed. My grandparents did it in the Great Depression. It was called canning. And we used to do it when I was growing up. We would do it with my grandmother, and we would do it with my aunt, and we would do it with my mother. And we as kids would have a garbage can full of beans, and we would get them ready, and then mom would put them in the canner, and we'd have beans for a year. Things have changed. You may not be doing it that way anymore, but now you can do it with My Patriot Supply. Go to preparewithglenn.com. A prepared America is a strong America, and that's Patriot Supply's mission. A strong America. Call 800-977-0542. It's 800-977-0542 or preparewithglenn.com.
Choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other things, not because they are easy, but because they are hard.
It's amazing that that happened on 9/12, and I didn't know it. 9/12 is such an important date in my life, and I think the country's. And here is John F. Kennedy saying, we're going to go to the moon at Rice University. And he said that on September 12th. 9/12, the day to me that we had a moonshot ourselves. We chose to come together and to do the hard things. Now we have gotten lost. Quite honestly, I don't think we ever made it. We may have made it to the moon, but I don't think we ever made it back. I think we got a few people trapped on the moon right now. When it comes to our moonshot of this decade, as he said,
I'm afraid. Tragedy is just a drug at this point. Like, these things happen and they give you that feeling for a while, and man, it seems to go away.
You know what is a drug?
Get worse.
You know what is a drug? USA, USA, USA. That was the drug, because that's not a solution. That's not a solution, just like it wasn't when George Bush said, you know what, you got to do your part, go shopping. That's not a solution. Those two things, nationalism, shopping, and everything else, those are drugs. But there are things that we can do that are not drugs that actually change things. More next.
Glenn Beck. This is the Glenn Beck Program.
I remember the day my life changed. The day my life changed happened in a cafeteria at Yale University. And the guy sitting across the table was Wayne Meeks. He doesn't even know this, but he changed my life. He changed the course of my life. I was 30 years old. I was... early in the recovery of my alcoholism. The day I started school literally was the day I asked for a divorce. And I was just searching. I had been searching for answers. And I had gotten into Yale University, and I couldn't believe it, because when I sent for my transcripts, I thought I was like a C or D student. And I wasn't. I was a straight A student. And that's not that wasn't my memory at all. My memory had so decayed and I had been so down on myself over the years that I really had convinced myself that I was pretty stupid and always had been. And so when I put my transcripts together and I, put my package together and sent it in for special student status at Yale, I really didn't expect to get in. Then when I did get in, oof, I was like, I don't think I can do this. And my professor said to me one day, he said, Mr. Beck, after I had questioned him on something, he said, can I see you after class? I said, yes, sir. After class, he said, come have lunch with me. So we sat in this cafeteria, this Ivy League, hallowed halls, oak paneled room. And he said, what are you doing here? And I said, I'm just looking for answers. I have never spent any time in my life trying to figure things out. And I realize that I don't know anything. And I'm really looking for answers. And he said, what are you reading? And I told him. And he said, who's guiding you through that? And I said, either Mr. Barnes or Mr. Noble. I'm not sure which, but that's, I'm just going into the bookstore. And I'm looking for people who disagree with each other. And I'm comparing and contrasting. He said, you're doing that on your own? I said, yes. And I'm so confused. I don't even know. He reached across the table as I was in the middle of that. My hand was down on the cafeteria table. And he reached over and he put his hand on top of mine. And he said, listen to me. You know you belong here, right? You know you're smart enough to be here. I think I answered yes, but the answer in my head was no. Him saying that to me gave me the confidence to know it's going to be okay. Sometimes one conversation can change the course of so much. There was a caller to this program. He didn't know me. We had never met. I'd never talked to him before. He had never talked to me. And yet his phone call changed the course of my life. He called in to tell me what he believed. And what he believed was that we were all alone.
The problem is today, and I believe this, I believe that we're outnumbered now. I don't believe...
We're not. We're
I know
not.
You say that, and I knew
we're
you were going to get mad
Damn
at me.
It.
I knew it.
We're not outnumbered. We are not outnumbered.
You look at
you know
the
what
polls,
I got it. You know what
every,
I am. Look, here's right. The thing.
You, Ed, you give me a month to prove this. I am going to find a way to prove this to you. I, you know what, Stu? I'm going to give you, Ed, you hang on the phone. I want to get a phone number from you.
Yep.
Okay. Thank you for calling. And Ed, you are probably the most important caller that I have ever received in my career.
Glenn, please remember the first sentence I said when I called on the phone.
I understand. I appreciate, Ed, that I just appreciate it. And you may be the most important person in my life because you may have changed and finally given me the impetus to actually find the way to prove it to you.
9/11 caused so much heartbreak in America, but it didn't harden our hearts. When the wreckage settled after 9/11, Americans everywhere united. We didn't even know what to do. But we knew what we had was worth fighting for. But we weren't given any real specific direction except go shopping. I still believe in who we are at our core. We are the people that we were on 9/12. We are the people of Hurricane Harvey. People who are thirsty. They are thirsty to be involved to help their fellow man. So Ed calls me, and he did change the course of my life. I knew who we were, and it was that call that gave birth to the 9/12 Project. It was a grassroots initiative that spread like wildfire. We had 6 months before 9/12. We had a watch party, if you will. I asked everybody, watch at 5 o'clock. And people gathered all over the country. Do you remember watching it together?
No matter where you are, from our studio audience here in Midtown Manhattan, to the sidewalks outside, to the people all over the country, just a few blocks away in Times Square, where there are people at viewing parties. They're holding regular viewing parties, started with people and by people, just regular people like you, like Joyce in Melbourne, Florida, whose party grew so large that she moved it from her restaurant to the parking lot outside, to the gatherings in Noah's in South Jordan, Utah, to homes in Golden Valley, Arizona, and Brewer, Maine, to the garage bar in Columbus, Ohio, and virtually every small town and big city in between in this great nation. There are people gathering in ranches in Texas, where some familiar faces have gathered to watch the show, to military bases in Iraq, where real heroes have gathered.
I don't think I've seen those images until just now, since that day. Amazing people who were not just watching a television show. They came together because they believed in a few things. The 9 principles and the 12 values. That America is good. That there is a God. That we have to try to be more honest than we were yesterday. That our families are sacred. And my spouse and my family, we are the ultimate authority, not the government. And if you break the law, you have to pay the penalty. And justice is blind, and no one is above that. That I do have a God-given right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. But there's no guarantee of equal results. And I've worked hard for what I have. And I will share it with who I want to. And the government can't force me to be charitable. And it's not un-American for me to disagree with authority or share my personal opinion. And the government works for me. I don't answer to them. They answer to me. Those were the principles. They're still true today. The values of honesty and reverence and hope and thrift and humility and charity, sincerity, moderation, hard work, courage, personal responsibility, and gratitude. It might sound like a big ask to a lot of people just to live those things, but people rise to the level of their preparedness and their knowledge. They don't rise to the level of their expectations. The reason why people today are rising up to help the people in the flood and they're just giving everything is because that's how they were raised and prepared by parents. I just wanted to prove that to Ed and to myself, that there was a majority of Americans that care enough about their country to do their homework. Television is a great medium. It's like anything in the free market. It can be used for good or can be used for evil. A lot of people think I used it for evil. I tried so hard to use it for good. But television can be really isolating. And on August 28th, 2010, I invited everybody to join me on the mall in Washington, D.C. I really had no expectation. I had no idea how many people would show up. We didn't have unions and organizers all over the country that were bringing people in. It was just up to you and your local church or whatever you wanted to do. And to my shock, 500,000 people showed up in Washington, D.C.
This day is a day that we can start the heart of America again. And it has nothing to do with politics. It has everything to do with God. Everything, turning our face back to the values and the principles that made us great.
But this was not just an American thing. And it wasn't just about honor. What was coming required us to also have courage. And so the next year, when we were starting a network, our very first internet broadcast was international. Quite a feat. It was from Israel, which we thought might turn into a war zone just because of the things we had to say there.
I ask you to turn your eyes to Israel and restore courage. I have been asked by the press over and over again, what is it you think you can teach Israel about courage? My answer is simple. Nothing. They asked me then, so then why would you come to Israel? Because I say, in Israel, you see courage.
Americans are resilient, but only if we're prepared. We're made from tough stock, man. Really tough. We crossed the oceans to get here. We were broke. We were penniless. We crossed the mountains with oxen. 2012, we had gone through a lot. 11 years of labor. And there was one more piece to put together if we were going to make it. It was honor, courage, but most importantly, it was love. From the heart of Texas, it was time to remind everybody and those unbreakable values and principles of the 9/12 Project from Cowboy Stadium.
There are two kinds of Americans, and they're not Democrats and Republicans. They're not God-fearing and God-doubting. They're not black and white. They're bigger than that, much bigger. There are two kinds of Americans, those who like to be pushed and those who push themselves, those who see our problems and refuse to see our blessings.
Close your eyes for a second and just imagine that we are in an oak-paneled room. And that you are saying to me the same thing that you probably said to your wife or husband last night or in the last 24 hours. I don't know. I don't have any. I don't know. I don't know how we're going to make it. I don't know. let me reach across and put my hand on top of yours and say, you know you belong here, right? You know you're in the right place. Even if you don't believe it yet yourself, believe me, you're gonna make it.
Tonight on theblaze.com/TV, we will have a call-in show kind of talking about 9/12. We're going to do our best to make Glenn cry again.
I want to hear your, because I have never heard your side of the story of the 9/12 project.
Yeah, we'll show that coming up. And also, we'll try to make you cry by showing videos of you looking really thin from several years ago.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. That's already doing that. Recent FBI report puts the average property loss from one home break-in at about $2,000. $2,000 is what the is going to but what you lose after one burglary. There are people that want your stuff. There are people that think they deserve your stuff. It's really important that you protect your home with SimpliSafe Home Security. Now you can protect every door and every window in your home. You can get motion sensors and entry sensors. SimpliSafe system is completely wireless, so you can set it up yourself without drilling any holes in your wall. And you have professional alarm monitoring around the clock. So they'll call police, they'll call fire, whether you're there or not. And it's $15 a month. And it's month by month. There's no contract. With SimpliSafe, you can be sure that your home and your things, your children, the things that are important to you are protected. Go to SimpliSafeBeck.com. Get a special 10% discount today when you order. Or if you want the security system right away, you can go to your local Best Buy and you'll have your home protected by tonight. You can find it at Best Buy. Or online, get a 10% discount by going to SimpliSafeBeck.com. That's SimpliSafeBeck.com.
Glenn Beck.
That's a strange, very strange show. It's a strange day. We have Max Lucado in the wings. He's going to be with us in just a second on how to survive chaos in the world. And strangely, we seem to have Hillary Clinton with it. And I don't know if it's the lighting or what it is, but she looks better here on TV and radio than she normally does.
Thank you, Glenn.
It's her book has been released, and we have the video excerpts of her book. We're going to share that coming up real soon as well.
Glenn Beck.
Oh, thank you. Seared steak and roasted potatoes, Anko chili chicken tacos, roasted pork and salsa verde.
Yes, please.
Sesame, beef lo mein, fresh gnocchi with summer squash.
Yes, please.
Okay. You might think to yourself, I would like to go to a restaurant and get those things. What if you could get them at home? What if you don't have to go out? What if you can eat these in your you know, bedpans?
Again, yes.
Yes,
in your
please.
Bedpan?
Yeah.
What did you
bed
say?
Bedpants.
Oh, bed pants.
Yeah, why would I eat them in a bed pan?
Like, why would you be eating your dinner in a bed pan?
No one wants bed pan.
You can actually make this stuff and make it delicious with Blue Apron. It's for less than $10 per person per meal. Blue Apron delivers seasonal recipes along with pre-portioned ingredients to make delicious home-cooked meals. No waste. You don't have to figure out. You don't have to measure all sorts of stuff. It's all there in the exact amount that you need it, and they make it super easy. Check out this week's menu and get your first three meals free with free shipping by going to blueapron.com/stew. blueapron.com/stew. Blue Apron, a better way to cook.
Love, courage, truth.
I want you to know that you are the answer. You really are the answer. The power to change yourself, the power to change America's course, resides in you. It's what the message of the 9/12 Project was all about. Your ability to effect change with principles over politics and policies. Over the weekend on 60 Minutes, we saw the opposite of this from Steve Bannon. He sat down with Trump's former chief strategist on 60 Minutes, who said this.
I'm going to be his wingman outside for the entire time to protect.
So you'll not be attacking Donald Trump in your role.
No. Our purpose is to support Donald Trump, by the way.
And destroy his enemies?
To make sure his enemies know that there's no free shot on goal.
You know, I remember the days when we called out those people who put blind faith in President Obama. Personality over principles. America, what has changed? Nothing. Nothing except our belief in ourself. Nothing but the belief that we're going to make it. I want you to hear clearly. We're going to. Charisma over core values always fall short. And one voice can change a community. One voice can change a family. One family changes a community. One community changes a state. One state changes a nation. One nation changes the world. But it starts with you. You are the answer. And then together, grounded in our shared principles, we create something that is durable and has lasting impact.
It's Tuesday, September 12th. This is the Glenn Beck Program.
Max Lucado from San Antonio, Texas. He started a small church in Miami, Florida, and now he's in San Antonio. He's been a pastor for 40 years. He's authored 34 books, 43 different languages. 97 million copies of his books are in print. He's been married 34 years, has a granddaughter, has three wonderful children, and a very important message in his new book, Anxious for Nothing, which, Max, I had to have you on because I think this is the answer to much of what the world is facing right now. We are so anxious about everything, and through, I think, misdirection, we're blaming it on all kinds of different things and all different people, but it's really this anxiety. First of all, where do you think it's coming from? What are we experiencing?
Thanks for letting me on the program,
sure.
By the way.
Yeah.
That's not just an assumption on your part. You know, sociologist after sociologist has told us, and I document a lot of this in the book, that we are now the most anxious nation on the planet, and this is the most anxious generation since anxiety was ever measured. Third world countries score healthier on the anxiety list than the United States does. So how could this be? We have more gimmicks, more gadgets, more toys, more entertainment than ever, and yet we're wrapped tighter than Egyptian mummies. We're just anxious people. And so it's not just an assumption on your part. And I think the consequence of this, of course, is physical. Just about every malady can be traced back in some form to some form of stress. But I think also we pay a high price emotionally. We're losing the ability to have honest conversations with one another because we live in fear. We're anxious. And when you're anxious, you hunker down and you withdraw. And the result of that can be a breakdown in fellowship, community, dialogue.
We withdraw, but then we also gather in groups. This thing that's going on with dopamine now, of we get constant dopamine hits if we post something nasty on Facebook, mm-hmm. and it starts to go viral. Our brain is rewarding us for that with a feel-good drug, and I don't know how that's going to break, because we're looking, we're strung out on opioids or on dopamine hits. And if you're not doing one of those two things, the suicide rate is going through the roof. People are not built to handle this kind of stress.
The suicide rate between 1999 and today has gone up 24%.
Wow.
24%. Now, if we said that about a particular disease, we'd call it an epidemic. More people than ever are orchestrating their own departure, which gives rise to the question, what is happening in our culture to cause that
to
occur?
What is it?
I think from a sociologist's viewpoint, the common list includes, we've seen more change in the last 30 years than we've seen in the last 300. So the world is moving far too fast. Number two, we have forgotten how to slow down. Mm-hmm. Our great grandparents and ancestors would go only as far as the day as the horse or the camel would go. And then when the sun set, they would slow down. We have forgotten how to do that. And then also, the bombardment of negative news, not just political news, but just negative news. If something bad happens in Nepal, I hear about it within 5 seconds, whereas our ancestors never would have heard about it, or if they did, it would have been 5 weeks later. So we're just bombarded with negative news. So those are the three things that sociologists state. Can I add to that as a pastor?
Sure.
I think secularism is taking its toll on us. Secularism is the belief that there's nothing in life beyond what happens between birth and the grave, and there's nothing beyond the world to help us. Secularism really sucks the hope out of a culture, because if there's nothing more than what I can see and touch and feel, and I don't like what I can see and touch and feel, then I think I'll just check out.
So I want to play something for you that I saw this morning from Jim Carrey. He was giving an interview yesterday in New York, and it was some fancy celebrity thing, and everybody is reporting this as, look at Jim Carrey's kind of slapping down Hollywood and the elites and everything else. I don't think that's what's happening. I want you just to listen to what Jim Carrey said in an interview yesterday, because he is either really unhealthy or he's just starting to figure life out, and I can't decide which it is.
Hey, Jim Carrey. Yes.
What?
I've covered a lot of fashion weeks. This is the first time I've run in to Jim Carrey. Wait, tell me, is it true you're wandering the streets? You need a date to the party? What's up?
No. I'm doing just fine. I just, there's no meaning to any of this. So I wanted to find the most meaningless thing that I could come to and join, and here I am.
They're celebrating.
I mean, you got to admit, it's completely meaningless.
Well, they say they're celebrating icons inside.
Celebrating
Do you
believe icons.
In icons,
boy, that is just the absolute lowest aiming, you know, possibility that we could come up with. It's like icons. What do you believe in icons? I don't believe in personalities. I don't believe that you exist, but there is a wonderful fragrance in the air.
You don't believe certain icons have the power to make change, to think differently, to be bold, to inspire others? Artistry? You're one of them.
On the good foot. Ha! Yeah. You shut it down now. Yeah, no, I don't believe in icons. I don't believe in personalities. I believe that peace lies beyond personality, beyond invention and disguise, beyond the red S that you wear on your chest that makes bullets bounce off. I believe that it's deeper than that. I believe we're a field of energy dancing for itself. And I don't care.
But Jim, you got really dressed up for the occasion. You look good.
No,
was
I didn't
that an
get
accident?
Dressed up. I didn't get dressed
Who
up.
Who did?
There is no me.
There's no you.
No.
We're not here. This is a dream.
There's just things happening.
Stop.
And there are
He's a guy who's been going through trouble lately, a lot of personal trouble. And it's, to me, this is really concerning. I like the idea that he says all of this is meaningless, but I think he is to a point to where he means really all of this is meaningless. And there's a fine line between that.
Mm-hmm. He seems right on the edge of despair.
Yes.
And despair often is born out of a sense of utter, complete disappointment with life. You know, I've been at the top. I've had the very best. I've had all it could give me. And it's still vain. It's vanity. You know, there's a book in the Bible called Ecclesiastes, and King Solomon reached that same conclusion. You know, the richest man probably who ever lived, and he said it's nothing but, you know, there's vanity, and it has no meaning to me. And so this cry for meaning, this longing to be a part of something significant, is right at the core of the deepest need of a human being. Why am I here? Where am I going?
So where are we finding that now? Now that our churches, you know, are struggling. I think in some cases, for good reason, where do we find it? How do we put this back?
I know our churches are struggling, and oftentimes because of the way churches are structured, they can be so inauthentic that they come across to people as simply another way to earn money or to steal from people. And so that's created this disconnection between many people and the church. I really think, though, that we are beginning to sense, especially in the millennial generation, a sense of authentic faith among our young people. And it's very, very encouraging. And it's a faith that's really built upon a deep, deep conviction that there is a good God who is up to something good. They don't have all the answers, don't have all of the questions resolved, but there's a deep, deep conviction that we're seeing a fresh move of faith among our young people. And I find that very encouraging.
There are reasons to feel the chaos. There are reasons. I mean, there's real things that are happening, that people's jobs are at stake. They don't know how they're going to make ends meet. Their kids are in trouble. Suicide rate with youth is through the roof. There's real reason to feel this way. How do you disconnect from the very real things in your life? The hype of all of the things that you shouldn't worry about, and put that in order, and then find a peaceful place in it. You know, how did Martin Luther King, how was he in jail and fine? How did Dietrich Bonhoeffer thank his executioner? How do you do that?
And ask that very question in this book, because I based this book upon the writings of the Apostle Paul, and he wrote this book in a Roman jail cell.
Yeah.
And this book called Philippians in the Bible has come to be known as the Epistle of Joy. And yet there's 1,001 reasons he should not be happy.
Right.
I mean, the emperor was making a living off of killing Christians, and probably Paul was next in line. And here the Apostle Paul is chained to a Roman guard and has every reason to think he'll never see the light of day again. If it is, it's just for a few moments before his head is chopped off. And yet you read these four chapters and there's not one word of complaint, not one word of complaint. And it's, as you dig into this book, you find in this book really a deep and abiding trust in two simple facts, that there is a good God, and this good God is up to good things. And so I think that, you know, and I'm not saying anything that surprised you. I mean, I'm a pastor, but I know I'm supposed to say these things. But deep in my heart, I really believe that the cause of anguish and despair is a sense of meaninglessness.
It is.
Why am I here? Where am I headed? Why am I here? Where am I headed? And if you cannot answer those two fundamental questions in life, I mean, how do you get up on a Monday and go to work? You can only do it so many times before you become bitter and jaded and cynical.
I'd add to that that there's a deep sense in all of us of, I want to do something of meaning.
Mm-hmm.
And we can't find it. We can't find that something of meaning. We're talking to Max Licato. In a second, I want to talk to him about chaos, which we've just been talking about. But calm. C-A-L-M, calm the chaos. In a minute.
The book by Max Licato is Anxious for Nothing, Finding Calm in a Chaotic World. At some point I want to ask Max about the question my kid asked me the other day with the hurricane bearing down. It was one of those, why is God sending the hurricane? Is it to kill people? And I thought that was probably, I didn't want to say yes to that. So I said, hey, look, Daddy's iPad is charged. Here you go, kid. That was probably not the response Max will give.
We'll get to that here in just a second. North Korea just last week tested a hydrogen bomb. That news came as Hurricane Harvey, and now 6 million Floridians are without power with Irma. We have a really resilient country. We are experiencing more pressure points, I think, than I've ever experienced in my life. Change is afoot, but
as Max just said, God's up to something, and he's up to something good. But we have to do our part and be able to relieve some of the stress and be able to take some of the things off of the table that we can actually control. And one is, I don't know what's going to happen with the dollar. I don't know what's going to happen with jobs or anything else. But I do know that I can spread my risk around so I don't lose everything if I've got everything in my 401k and it's in stocks. Why do that? Why do that? Would you consider taking 10% of whatever it is you have in your 401k or your IRA and at least discussing with Goldline gold as an investment opportunity? It is, you know, from the very beginning of time, gold was the refuge, the shelter that people sought. Right now, Goldline is extending their price protection program for as little as $2,500. You can get 3 months of price protection, which means if the price goes down, they make it up with more gold, all the way up to a year of that insurance for $25,000 investment. Nobody else is offering this. Make sure you read their important risk information. Find out if gold or silver is right for you. It's not right for everybody. 1-866-GOLDLINE. 1-866-GOLDLINE or goldline.com.
Glenn Beck.
Max Licato, a great new book everyone should read. It's called Anxious for Nothing, Finding Calm in a Chaotic World.
So this really happened the other day. My son is six, and he's watching some of the people talking about the hurricane. My mom lives in Georgia, was threatened by it at one point. And he asked, why does God send hurricanes? Is it to kill people? So I surely did not answer the question correctly. But how do you answer something like that to a six-year-old?
Yeah. How do you answer when a six-year-old's father's diagnosed with cancer or when someone's in a car wreck, like a family in our congregation was recently, and a man had his first baby on Monday and he was killed in a car wreck on Saturday. Mm-hmm. It's just these kind of things just, you know, they leave our heads spinning.
And it's not even 6-year-olds that ask that. There's 60-year-olds.
No.
There's 96-year-olds that ask that question.
Yeah. Why do bad things happen to good people?
Yeah.
You know? And I think that's where the heart of the conversation is. The real heart is there a God? And if he is a God, what kind of God is he? You know, is there a God? Is he in control? And if he's in control, why do bad things happen? And I think the Bible talks about that over and over. You know, Jesus said many times, for example, in this world you will have tribulation, but be of good cheer, I've overcome the world. The ultimate answer for human suffering, according to the Bible, is it's not supposed to be this way. It's not supposed to be this way. The world was not created to have hurricanes and tornadoes. Our bodies were not intended to have to deal with cancer cells and heart conditions. My dad died of ALS. You know, mm-hmm. the body is not supposed to be this way. But there's a good day coming. There's a better day coming. Don't lose hope. Don't give up. I promise I'm going to take what is difficult, tragic, and I'm going to redeem it into something good. And this is what led one Bible writer to say that the promise of the future glory is not worth comparing with the difficulties we have today. In other words, the small potato struggles we have are going to be long forgotten in the next life, in the new life. I know that requires faith. I know that that's hard for some people to believe. I've tried not believing it, and I think the idea of not having faith is far more difficult to me than having faith. And so ultimately, the answer is it's not going to be this way forever.
I'm going to lay the blame at the feet of Eve. Adam and Eve are getting it for me. I think that's what you said. So.
Don't give them my email address.
Max, I have a great short story to share with the audience of it's how you look at your situation that we're going to share here in a minute. And I've run out of time, but I want to come back for one more segment with you because I want you to explain CALM. In a world of chaos, the answer is calm. And we get to that next.
Glenn Beck.
You're listening to the Glenn Beck Program.
Max Licato has a new book out called Anxious for Nothing. And the it, as each passing day goes by, I kind of feel like that. I kind of feel like, you know, there are real reasons to be anxious. There's real pressure on right now. The world's changing. But really, how much of that really matters? I mean, you know, you either have the faith that it's gonna be fine and we're going to make it, or you don't. And if you don't have the faith, then, you know, it's trouble. You say the answer is calm.
Yeah. I would even go so far as to say I think we each have a moral obligation to be peaceful people. You know, we have a moral obligation. I owe it to you and to you to be as peaceful as I can be. And rather than stir up anxiety everywhere I go, if I can learn to bring peace, like you said earlier, Glenn, one person is changed and that person changes a family, that person family changes a community and then a state and then a nation and then the world. I have a moral obligation to do all I can do to be a peaceful person, because in the long term, if enough of us do that, we create a peaceful place. And so that's why I've been so fascinated with this whole theme of anxiety. We're an anxious nation. An anxious nation makes bad decisions. An anxious nation is on edge, and anxious people cannot get along with each other. Peaceful people, on the other hand, have dialogue, have community, talk through their differences, and learn to disagree agreeably. These are characteristics of peaceful people. Anyway, so all of that to say, how do you become that? The book in the Bible called Philippians is a book about peace. And in this book, the apostle says, here's four things you can do. Number one, you celebrate God. The way he says it is, rejoice in the Lord always. Again, I say rejoice. Mm-hmm. He must have been a preacher because he says everything twice. Rejoice in the Lord always. Again, I say rejoice. So the next time you feel anxious, just take a minute and rejoice in God. Rejoice in the sunshine. Rejoice in his goodness. Rejoice in what you got. And then the apostle says, be anxious for nothing. There's the phrase. But in everything by prayer and petition, let your requests be made known to God. So instead of letting the anxiety settle within you, immediately lift the cause or source of that anxiety to God. Make a prayer out of it. And then the apostle says, do this with thanksgiving. That is to say, leave it with God. And then lastly, he says, now meditate on good things. And he gives us a list of like nine different virtues upon which to meditate. In other words, set your mind on better things. It's a real practical thing, I think, Glenn, that the apostle, who had every reason to be stressed out, found peace. And he says, here's how I do it.
Max, it is good to talk to you. And you have been an influence on my life and many, many, many people that I know. And
well,
it is,
thank you.
It is great to have
and
you.
And it's
here.
Mutual.
Thank
it's
you
mutual.
So much. Thank
every
you.
Every conversation is better than the other.
God bless you.
The book is Anxious for Nothing, Finding Calm in a Chaotic World. Max Licato is the author. And thank you for helping me parent, Max. I appreciate it.
I want to talk to you a little bit about what is required to actually make a change. And I believe it is hope. Sujo John, a guy that I met, he was in the North Tower on 9/11. I want to tell you his story today. He is a guy who left his hometown of Calcutta, and he only carried hope in his heart. He knew that he and his family would have a better life if he could just make it to America.
I came to America in February of 2001 with $50 in my wallet and two bags. And I came to America to chase dreams. And even before coming to America, I just knew that America is a place where dreams and dreamers collide. So I came here to chase adventure and prosperity, have degrees in business. That's all I had. And a faith to lean on and a country to put my feet on.
So John and his wife, they wanted to contribute to society and elevate their careers. And they were always working hard to have the best of the best of everything. And because of that, they found themselves in the concrete jungle of Manhattan, New York City.
My wife first finds work. She started working on the 71st floor of the South Tower. And I'm frantically looking for work. And no one would employ me because I have no U.S. work experience. And one day there's a job fair at the World Trade Center, the Marriott World Trade Center. And the girl who was interviewing me, she said, I want you to give this company a shot because your wife works there. It'll be great to work along with her in the same building or the building next to it. So my interview was on the 81st floor of the North Tower. And what got me was the view. She pulled down the blinds, and I see the Statue of Liberty. And for an immigrant, you know, your first job working in America and to be working in a building like the World Trade Center and to be seeing that site, I thought this would be a great shot to start with.
So he had no idea. He didn't know it at the time, but that view of the Statue of Liberty would soon be obstructed with fire and smoke and debris. Just a few months after his arrival in New York, John would be a firsthand eyewitness to the most tragic event in American history.
The building shook violently. Jet fuel made its way into our floor. Fire breaks out around us. Walls collapsing. And as we look up, there's a huge crater. We can actually see 10 floors directly above us.
So here he is. And he tells me, I couldn't even process to what was happening to the building. He said, I'm in the North Tower. The only thing that's happening is the South Tower. Because most days, he and his wife rode the subway to work together. He was in the North Tower, but she was in the South Tower. She slept in just a little bit on that day. She was due at the office in any minute.
I thought about my wife. She's 4 months pregnant. And I knew she was in the other tower. She had called me saying, I'm almost there. I'll see you soon.
So he tries calling her. The only thing he could do was try to make his way down 81 smoke and fire saturated floors and find her. Hope was the only thing that John had.
The most amazing thing was there's people of all backgrounds, of all color, of all nationalities, but I just saw the best of people come out that day. And when we go to the 43rd or the 44th floor, and I think, Glenn, that's the most moving side of that day, we see firemen, policemen, one by one making their way up. And as we watched these men making their way up, we would ask ourselves, why are they going up? We had seen fire on almost every floor, and we had no idea then that that these men were literally making their way up to their death. Mm. I often tell people when I share my story, on 9/11, the worst form of evil came and attacked America. And the first response didn't really come to the military. The first response came to these men. They showed the world what this country was made up of. There are men and women willing to lay down their lives so that others like me could be around to be sharing our stories.
So he, with the help of the humanity of strangers, he makes it out of the South Tower. And amid the chaos on the ground, he searches frantically for his wife. No avail. Then his cell phone rings.
Late that day, my cell phone rings for the very first time. And it's my wife on the other side. And it was an amazing moment. I said hello, and she says hello, and she hears my voice. But her first words to me were, babe, are you alive?
So here he is, a guy who comes here for a life-changing experience, and he gets one, just not the one he thought it would be. He and his wife both survive 9/11, even though they were in separate towers, and their lives were forever changed. He had come to America with the hope of prosperity, but he wanted something more. When John got to work the morning of September 11th, 2001, this is before the planes crashed in the towers, I want you to listen to the prayer that was answered just before the planes hit. He sent an email to his friend.
I wrote an email at 8:05 in the morning from the towers to a friend of mine in my home church in New Jersey saying, Tom, something's happening to me this morning. I know there's a call of God upon my life. These last 6 months, I've been chasing stuff. I can't explain to you what I'm going through right now. I want to be chasing after that which is on God's heart. So I send that email from the towers at 8:05, and after about 40 minutes, this plane comes crashing. So I often joke about that by saying, I think God reads email.
He answers our prayers in unbelievable ways, and usually not the way we expect or... While we're in the middle of it, sometimes it's the way we're like, no, I didn't mean that. No, not this way. Our sponsor this half hour is Upside.com. Booking travel doesn't have to be a stressful event. Upside.com has the absolute best available prices for flights, hotel, and rental cars. Upside is going to reward you with a gift card to places like Amazon.com every time you buy a business trip. And the treatment you get from Upside, their customer service department is pretty amazing. They're called Navigators. Recently, a navigator noticed an Upside user was booked in a middle seat on a three-hour-plus flight. So the navigator upgraded her to an aisle seat with more legroom. The navigators, they're there just in case you just missed something and to make your flight and your stay much more pleasant. The navigators are instantly accessible 24/7 by voice, chat, email, or message on the Upside app. They'll even reach out to you with some useful information in case they see something and they're like, you know, this is going to cause you a problem. I don't think you meant to do what you just did. Upside.com. Use the promo code Beck and you're going to get a minimum $100 gift card from Amazon.com. That's promo code Beck, minimum of $100 gift card at Amazon.com when you buy your next business trip at Upside. Upside.com. You deserve a better business trip. Minimum purchase required. See site for complete details. It is Upside.com.
Glenn Beck.
Hillary Clinton's new book comes out, and much to my surprise, she happens to be in studio today. Stu, I guess we've allowed her to use one of our studios to record the video portion of her book. Is that what?
Well, I mean, I kind of look at this as charity work. You know, a lot of people helping with Houston and Irma and everything. Hillary needed a studio to record the video book, and we have a studio, so we felt
Wow, it is surprising that she took us up, but welcome. Welcome to the program, Hillary Clinton.
Hey, thank you.
Right.
Thank you.
You look, if you happen to be watching on the Blaze TV or online, you might notice Hillary looks, a little puffy, but you look nice.
I would describe it as better than normal.
Might be the lighting.
Thank you.
Might be the lighting.
Are we here to chat? Or
no,
are we here
go ahead.
To
we want to hear. We want to hear
my
some.
Book,
we want to hear the excerpts of the book from Hillary Clinton. These are the actual excerpts from the book.
It is hard to be a woman. You must think like a man, act like a lady, look like a young girl, and work like a horse. I have that sign hanging in my home.
Gets
me through the day.
Really? That was. Did you come up with that yourself, or
it's a sign that I've had for years?
You've had that for years. That's very nice.
You know, when I was writing the book, I wanted to write about exactly what happened through this last election.
Your voice seems to be going down a little bit.
You might lose, Bill told me.
Right.
That's true.
Was that the end of the excerpt of the book?
He nailed that one.
Right, he did. He nailed that.
In politics, the personal narrative is vital. My husband had a powerful story to tell. Barack Obama had a powerful story to tell. Few people would say that my story was quite so dazzling.
She knows she's boring. She's actually aware of it. And by the way, you were reading. I Jeffy, I appreciate your impersonation here. However,
holy cow! Wait a minute, that's Jeffy.
Yeah, no, I know. You can start to
surprise.
Wow, I had no idea.
You have way too much inflection in your voice for her crappy read on this audiobook. If you've heard
any
of
bad.
It is terrible.
She is bad.
All right. Is there more?
I grew up in a white middle class family in Park Ridge. That's a suburb of Chicago. My life looked like the lives of all the girls I knew. We attended excellent public or parochial schools where first-rate teachers had high expectations. I went to our local Methodist church for Sunday services and youth activities all week long. I was a Brownie, then a Girl Scout. It's a story that many would consider perfectly ordinary.
What an uninspiring tale.
But my story,
this is horrible.
But my story, or at least how I've always told it, was never the kind of narrative that made anyone sit up and take notice.
This is so sad.
We yearn for that show-stopping tale, that one-sentence pitch that captures something magical about America that hooks you and won't let go.
How about not turning it socialist? Do you have that line on you?
Mine wasn't it.
Did she really write that? Mine wasn't it? This is so depressing.
Wow. So the name of the book is What Happened? And here's the Blaze put together a list of all of the excuses from Hillary Clinton. So what happened? Russian interference through disinformation campaign, WikiLeaks, or Trump-Russia collusion. James Comey's criminal investigation of her private email server. Poor data voter data from the Democratic National Committee. Voter suppression and voter ID laws, sexism, racism, Barack Obama, Bernie Sanders and his supporters, Jill Stein, the mainstream media, specifically the New York Times for aggressively covering her email scandal, the Electoral College, bad polling, people who assumed she would win, gullible Americans, and fake news.
That's it, though. But are all those legitimate excuses, Hillary?
I mean, are we here for your list or my excerpts? Like, what am I doing?
What
here?
Happened is available in bookstores everywhere, and Hillary will be joining us again for another inspiring quote.
And if you're listening on the radio and you want to see Hillary as Jeffy on Facebook Live, you can go there right now and see it. It's worth it.
Whoa.
Truth.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other things, not because they are easy, but because they are hard.
That was 55 years ago today. I don't know what it is with the date of 9/12, but we decided to go to the moon on 9/12. That speech happened in Houston. Kennedy gave his famous "We choose to go to the moon." 12 years after Sputnik, we went from getting laughed at to landing men on the moon. October 4th, 1957, Soviet Union successfully launched what was called Sputnik into orbit. It was the first satellite. Soviets were kicking our butt. 2 months later, we tried to keep pace by launching the Vanguard TV-3. It exploded on the launch pad. We're the laughingstock. But it was the Sputnik moment that changed everything. We realized that we had to roll up our sleeves and get to work. And thus began the modern day space race. The race is, we're already afoot. But space alone was not really the objective. At least not with the Soviets. Now the space race is over, but there is a new objective. And this time, the space race, the new space race, is on AI. And I think the Sputnik moment has already occurred. The race is on now to be the first to build intelligent machines. The nation that develops AI, quote, will be the ruler of the world. And that's what Vladimir Putin said to a group of students last week in Russia. This was his version of "We choose to go to the moon." Styles are a little bit different. Kennedy was at his inspirational best. Putin was classic Putin. Quote, when one party's drones are destroyed by drones of another, we will have no choice but to surrender. The race now is on, but not towards the heavens. What is it we're creating now? Last year, the microchip maker NVIDIA began testing their version of self-driving cars, but this car was different than the ones being tested by Google and Apple and Tesla. This car was not programmed by a human. This car programmed itself. It learned to drive by watching a human drive, and then it wrote its own program. It's the latest development that AI has and has all of its supporters excited and has all of its naysayers scared. It's called deep learning. And the problem is some of these systems are becoming so complex that the human creators don't even understand them anymore. Machines that are writing their own code and learning how to make decisions without being prompted to do so. Their style of reason and thought is completely alien to the researchers trying to figure it out, trying to figure out what we created. This is what the world is racing to create. Super intelligence that learns on its own, thinks in a completely alien way, and has no human morality. With the way we're going with human morality right now, maybe that's a good thing. But the question is, the AI race is on, and Putin has just given his go to the moon speech. But 55 years from now, will history remember us as the winners or the losers of the AI race, no matter which side wins?
It's Tuesday, September 12th. This is the Glenn Beck Program.
29-year-old advertising guy sits down and he writes a book for his two daughters. He makes copies of it and he gives it to some friends. And it starts to be passed around. And pretty soon people are calling the bookstore saying, "How can I get a copy of this book?" They don't even know what it is. Because it was a Xerox copy of something that the guy had written for his daughters. It wasn't too much longer that there were 8 million copies of that one book in print and a number one television movie of the year. It was called The Christmas Box. The author, the dad, the advertising guy was Richard Paul Evans. He sold more than 17 million books, written 26 novels. 4 of his books have been made into television movies. In 2011, he called me and he said, "I have this idea for a 7-book series. It's called Michael Vay. And it is a story that I've just been told by publishers is too smart to be a kid's book." And I said, "Don't ever underestimate the youth." He said, "Right?" He sent me a copy of the first book. And Mercury, Inc. Said, "We'll help you publish this." It's now been a bestseller, and the 7th novel is out now. It is the last, Michael Vay, The Final Spark. It comes out today. And I have not read this one. If it is like the other 6, it is going to be thrilling to the end. And I'm going to be really upset that it is the last one. Richard Paul Evans, welcome.
Good to be here, Glenn. Thank you.
So is this really the last one?
I don't know. It is for right now because I've been writing 3 books a year, and they offered me $1 million to write the next one. I said, I will have to write it from a psych ward. I go, I am writing nonstop. I have no life. It's like, I will snap. I can't. So I need basically a year. I still have other contracts, finish them out, and then maybe come back. And part of me doesn't want to do that because I love to keep something just special.
And this one was, I mean, when you first talked to me about it, you were really, really clear that this was almost downloaded to you.
Still is. Someone asked me how the book ends and I go, I look at book 7 and there were things in book 1 that if I had not put them there, book 7 would not have been possible. And when I put him in the first book, I thought, where's this going? Why is he growing in power? That has no point in the book. There are some things that were happening that became completely relevant. And I didn't know it until the last year.
Why is this book downloaded like that to you?
Because I think there's a deeper message. I think it's a very spiritual message. It's by far the most complex thing I've ever written, even though
it's unbelievably, and it's so consistent. I mean, you've been writing this for 8 years, 9 years?
7 years.
7 years?
Yeah.
And I picked it up. I've only read the first chapter of this one, but it picks up right exactly where it was. And I mean, the complexity of this story over 7 years and 7 books is really difficult.
Right. The French publisher said, "We want an arc for the whole thing." I said, "I have no arc. I don't know where it's going. I don't know how it ends." And it really wasn't until about 9 months ago that I thought, oh my goodness, really, that's what happens. I go, this has actually followed some sacred scripture all the way through. I go, this is kind of amazing.
Amazing.
You know, I told you beginning, like the names were downloaded to me.
Yeah.
And then I realized that their initial spelled Mount Zion. I go, come on, that's bizarre, right? That's just a bizarre coincidence. But I have found more coincidences like that throughout the book.
And you think that this book is, I mean, it is my son. I don't think my son has enjoyed a series. I don't even think Percy Jackson, he made it all through all of them and liked them towards the end. And this has been 7 years, and every summer we read it and love it every single time. It's a tradition with us. And I don't think there's another book series that he has made it all the way through that he has liked all the way through, because he grew, you know, 7 years. Right. That's half his life. And he's grown up with this now. And it's still as relevant to him now. You know, you think, you know, you're 13 years old. Okay. It's not. You know, and he's reading everything. Jesus, summer. He was reading It, for the love of Pete. But he loves it, and he loves the messages in it. And it's pretty remarkable what's happening with the youth that are reading it.
That's absolutely true. I had a young woman. Well, you remember our first book signings, that they were like mostly adults. They looked like my adult book signings with a few kids. We just did the launch party for Michael Vay. We had between 4,000 and 5,000 kids come to it. So, but a few weeks ago, I received a letter from a young woman in Paris, and she said, "Mr. Evans, you've probably been wondering where I've been." And I said to my assistant, "Who is this?" I mean, she goes, "Oh, she writes about every week." And she says, "I'm not doing well. I'm in the hospital. I tried to kill myself." She said, "I have one friend in this world, and it's Michael Vay. And he gives me the strength to go on. Thank you." And I said, "Let's get her immediately." And I told her that Michael loves her, I love her, and that just how Michael has to face the Elgin and his Dr. Hatches. You will too, but you're going to do okay. And just hang in there. This is a hard time of life. And I think that's why I have so many youth who have disabilities, who have struggles. Even at my book signing, one group came, and I held one young woman. She kept crying. She said, "My father died during the second book." She goes, "Michael Vay has been there with me the whole time through it." So she goes, "I don't know what to do now that the seventh book is out." So the book means, to me, it's a very spiritual book in a sense that it's here to heal and to help kids and use.
Tell the story for anybody who hasn't read it. Tell the story.
Michael is a 15-year-old boy with Tourette syndrome who discovers he has electricity in his body, and he can shock people, basically, but he doesn't know what this is about and why he has this power. He learns that he's one of 17 kids who were an accident through kind of an MRI machine, and that there's a group trying to find them because they realize that they can create a better race than what's on this earth right now. And that's what it's about.
There were a lot more than 17 kids who were accidents in this world. You should know that. There's been a lot of crazy things that have happened, just to be clear.
You have Tourette's. Your son has Tourette's.
Yes.
But this is not... What's interesting about this is I think there is... Every kid is in this book. No matter if you were the outcast or you were the popular one. You were the bully or you were bullied. Every kid is in this book. And I think that is the secret of this, is every kid who reads it sees themselves, finds themselves in that character, or you knew that character growing up.
I agree. And I you know what's been interesting about this, Glenn, is that the publishing world has largely ignored it. The day it was, remember we're sitting here and the book was number one in the New York Times.
Yes.
And the Wall Street Journal did a story on the next big YA book, and it didn't even mention Michael Vay. It was not only number one, it was 6 times higher than the book next to it. Even today, it's like I had a book signing with 5,000 people, and I don't know. I don't know. I've been attacked by having a male hero, as if this is a bad thing. Boys need heroes right now so bad.
Big time.
Yeah, and it's like
this is really, you know what I compare this to is the Flash series now that's now on television, where it's a boy hero. He's a great role model, loves his parents, has all of these great things going for him, and I think it's what people want, but I don't think that's what the media wants. I don't think they don't want that. They don't want something that, you know, a boy who loves his mother and treats his mother with respect and treats others with respect and does the right thing. And yes, he is the hero of the story. And while there are other girls around that also are heroines in the story,
you know, they're separate and distinct and they all have their own thing. I don't think that's what the people want. I don't think that's what culture is saying that is acceptable.
That's exactly right. That's true. We see it like when they came out with Maze Runner, and it was a young boy series, and it was one of the few YA books that made money in the movies. And it's like, well, big surprise. It's like, well, boys like this. They want to read. And the girls will read either way. Now, there's some very, very strong girl characters. Taylor is just as strong as Michael.
Yeah.
He takes counsel from her. This isn't a gender war. These are people trying to get along. And like you said, I remember a school teacher saying to me, Michael loves his mother. She was like freaked out. Like, he loves his mother. He says so. It's like, well, yeah, most boys do love their mother. This is reality. And so I think Michael Vay has this truth to it that resonates with kids. It's also, I hear every single day, multiple letters every day for the last 7 years saying, you got my kid to read. And when I hear it, every single day, it's like, this is the only book or only series my kid has ever read, especially the reluctant male readers.
Yeah.
One school teacher said in 18 years is the first time every student in the class finished the assignment. One boy took his grade from an F to an A- because he practically memorized Michael Vay. And I said, well, because you have to give them books they like to read. I was a reluctant reader.
Yeah, so was I.
I didn't read till I found The Hobbit.
Mm-hmm.
The Hobbit changed my world. I realized that reading actually could be fun. And The Hobbit's a very intelligent book, right?
Yeah.
And when I pick it up, it's like, there's no pictures in here. Why would I want to read this?
Right.
And the next thing I know, it's like, I want to be in,
for me,
in
it
the
was,
book.
For me, it was Sherlock Holmes.
Mm.
And I think this happens with Michael Vay. I read Sherlock Holmes. I was probably 18, maybe 19 years old. Hated reading. Found that book, and I read it, I think, two or three times. Because I was like, no other book could be this. I mean, this is really good, right? And so you just read it over and over again until you get sick of it. And you're like, what if there's something else? And then once you go down that rabbit hole, Rafe hated to read. He told me, he must have been six, right around this time. Never gonna. I don't like to read, Dad. I don't like to read books. I don't. Now, Tanya and I feel like the worst parent in the world because we're always saying, you say that to him. I'm not going to say that to him. Put the book down. Go out and do something. Go play a video game. Put the book down. Go put the book down. I think Michael Vay had a lot to do with that. The book comes out today. If you have not read the series, this is the last in the series. Does it have a satisfying ending?
Yes. It has a very powerful ending.
Does it have a Death Star in it?
No. Okay. And no Tyrannosaurus Rex.
Okay, but, darn it.
I read the last page to my assistant, and she broke down crying. And she goes, my friends, you'll love the ending. The big question is, where's Michael Vay? It will shock you, no pun intended, when you find out what's really going on. There's so many reveals. You'll feel like, wow, after 7 years, I finally get it.
Is there a TV show coming?
Looks like it. At the launch party, we had Hollywood executives there.
Excellent.
And the crowd was crazy.
Excellent. Yeah. Excellent. This will be a great TV show. It is a great series. Pick it up. Michael Vay, The Final Spark. If you haven't, started, start from the beginning. You will not regret it. And you read it with your kids. It is a fantastic series.
Michael Vay, The Final Spark, is the seventh book in the Michael Vay series. You can buy all of them. He didn't take the other ones off the market, so you can catch up whenever you want. We'll tweet the link at World of Stew on Twitter.
Let me tell you about Rick's story. Rick is a 91-year-old. He has a 91-year-old father. He was ready to move into an assisted living home, but that left Rick selling his dad's home. Rick went to realestateagentsitrust.com. And found an agent right away named Aaron. And Aaron took that stressful situation as they're moving Rick's dad into an assisted living home. You know, we got to clean out dad's house. We got to coordinate the repairs. Aaron helped with all of that. Aaron's team, top notch, got Rick's dad's home sold for the most amount of money and really quickly. RealEstateAgentsITrust.com. They're going to help you find a great real estate agent in your town or the town you want to move to. Thousands of families have already put realestateagentsitrust.com to the test, and the results are really, truly remarkable, and you can read about them and find out more about them at realestateagentsitrust.com. Get your home sold on time and for the most money right now. realestateagentsitrust.com.
Glenn Beck.
I want to come back, if we don't have time today, I want to come back tomorrow to Jim Carrey. This audio that came out yesterday is disturbing, I think. What do you think of that?
It was bizarre.
Yeah.
Completely bizarre. But that's kind of him, right?
I mean,
you don't think that's his shtick?
I don't have a good feeling about this.
Because the last clip we played was really him being introspective and talking about faith, and it was great.
Yeah. So he's either really gotten it or he's gone over the edge. I'm not sure which. And it's a fine line. He's almost nihilistic in what he said today. Now, you know, there's nothing of value here. None of this celebrity stuff means anything. That's all good. But is that as far as he's going? You know what I mean? Is that what he's saying? Or is he like, nothing has meaning? I'm not sure. It was a very bizarre interview, especially if you watch it. You could check it at theblaze.com. Also, today at 5 o'clock on The Blaze TV, doing a special, Stu and I are going to take you behind the scenes on 9/12. This is the day that we started the network. This is the day that we changed our lives. This was the 9/12 project. This is a really important day for us.
Yeah, it really is. And there's a lot of, we have a lot of cool clips from back in the day, going through all of these events and
the behind the scenes stories, etc., etc., and your phone calls tonight, 5 o'clock, The Blaze TV.
Glenn Beck. This is the Glenn Beck program.
Well, we have Hillary Clinton still coming up in studio in just a few minutes that you don't want to miss.
I saw her out in the hallway. She's
how was that?
Quite lovely.
Yes,
really she's surprisingly beautiful.
Was it awkward for you?
A tad, you know, because we have said some things about her, but she seemed to be understanding.
So she'll be joining us here and reading excerpts from her new book.
Very nice,
which is out called What Happened. don't want to miss that. So Pat is here. Yesterday, Pat started his own radio program on The Blaze Radio, immediately following this program. You can find that at theblaze.com on TV and radio. And it went really well yesterday. People were like, wow,
can he talk by himself?
He can do that. Yeah, we're like,
but he can't walk at the same time, right?
No. We're not even asking
you to do
that.
We're not trying that. Yeah. We're not going to try that right now.
You're bringing us some news today about Miss America. The Miss America pageant happened, and the contestants were asked all kinds of...
Yeah, well, Miss America is now apparently solving deeply troubling geopolitical crises.
Yes.
Oh, good.
And I feel pretty good about that. Mm-hmm. Here's one of the... They were all political, every single one of them. Here's one of the questions.
From Jess Cagle.
Last month, a demonstration of neo-Nazis, white supremacists, and the KKK in Charlottesville, Virginia, turned violent and a counter-protester was killed. The president said there was shared blame with, quote, very fine people on both sides. Were there? Jeez. Tell me yes or no and explain.
I think that the white supremacist issue, it was very obvious that it was a terrorist attack. And I think that President Donald Trump should have made a statement earlier addressing the fact and making sure.
Okay, thanks, Putin. Go put on your bikini, will you please? I mean, come on. We're talking about 20-year-old beauty contestants here, not senior fellows at some egg-headed political think tank.
Well, hang on. Miss America is supposed to be...
She's
beautiful. She's also supposed to be smart.
She can play the piano and she can help children. Those are the things she can do. Right. This is like interviewing an applicant for a job at 7-Eleven and asking them to use Lagrangian mechanics to solve Lagrangian equations of the second kind.
I didn't know the first kind. So,
well, I mean, please don't be insulting.
If you don't see the first kind, can you see the second kind?
No,
I saw Close Encounters of the First Kind. Does that count?
Okay. No, that does not. But we also want you to use judicious choices of generalized coordinates while you do it. Right. Before you can touch our Slurpee machine or sell a single 40-year-old hot dog. Why are we asking these questions of Miss America? Because even Miss Texas answers it that way.
Because, you know what? Honestly, this is just shaping the culture. You notice there was a trap there. Yes or no.
Right, right.
And yes. Then explain. So if you answered yes.
And you have 30 seconds, right?
No one is going to listen. No one is going to listen. True. All they're going to play is yes. And you're out. Your life is destroyed. Very and that's true. What that is. It's all about boxing people into one point of view. One simple, mindless answer.
And we can't get the media to hold presidential candidates to the standard of actually answering yes or no. Why does Miss America have to do it?
I know. Trump was never, he was never pinned down during the campaign, if you remember right. I mean,
Trump, Hillary.
Hillary
was. Guys, there weren't.
Guys, Obama guys, was wait, never
don't,
pinned
don't
down.
Don't talk she's about up. Hillary. She's right out in the hallway.
She's out the hallway.
She's going to be out
in here in a minute. Will you stay for that, Pat?
I would love to.
Because I mean, it might feel, I don't want to feel like we're ganging up on her, but...
It will be 3-1 at that point, though.
I just want to hear from her book and ask tough questions about
okay,
it.
So we'll, okay, so we'll get to that here in a second. But anyway, so the so Miss America, was anybody else cornered with these?
Yes, almost every contestant was asked some sort. Actually, one of them, and I don't remember from what state, but she was asked about the Russian interference in the election, whether it happened, what is your verdict? You're on the jury now. Please answer. And she actually said, innocent right now because I don't have enough evidence, which I thought was amazing.
That's an excellent one.
It's really amazing.
It's interesting. I wonder if part of this is the desire to get in, like, sort of YouTube culture, to get the we don't have maps moment that happened to, what was it, Miss Teen South Carolina. Like, they want to stump them into some dumb answer so that they can, that can be the
what
the thing.
Kind of show would you, what, okay, I'm going to sign up to be Miss America. I'm going to sign up to be anything, and the people who are judging it are setting me up to destroy my life.
I
not
think
just
that's
to make me
though.
Luke, just to destroy my right. entire life.
Welcome to every reality show on television, by the way.
Yeah, but that you volunteer for?
Well, you're volunteering. You're not, it's not. We don't have a draft culture in Miss America. They all volunteer.
You think not? You think not?
I
it's
will
coming.
Also say for Miss Teen South Carolina. That maps answer was in 2007. Stu and I were still playing that on our show last week. So that was huge for her.
It was huge for her.
She's thrilled. Huge. She's thrilled.
She's made a career out of it.
She's thrilled that the band is broken up.
We're getting it back together this Friday, though.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
Yeah, Glenn out this Friday. A little Pat and Stu reunion tour.
Mm-hmm.
We'll be filling in.
I'm going to Nantucket this weekend. I'm speaking 2 or 3 times at what's called the Nantucket Project.
It's pretty cool.
And the Farrelly brothers have decided that they were not coming because I was going to be there.
Oh, I believe that.
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wait.
Yeah.
Wait, how am I learning about this now?
They want no part of you. I could imagine that. Yeah. So they were coming and now they're not.
I've heard that they were not coming, but who knows?
Because aren't the Farrelly brothers sisters now? Aren't they both women?
I don't know.
I think you're thinking of the people who did The Matrix. Which is a different...
The
Farrelly brothers did, like, there's something about Mary, right? Is that
They've done some great comedies.
The Wachowski brothers are the ones...
That's it.
Which are not brothers anymore now.
They're sisters.
They're sisters. But
they're diverse family.
So I guess at least one of them was not real happy and was, like, not going to come. And I don't know if he's coming or not, or they're coming or not, but...
So you found even more people who don't like you.
Oh, no. Oh, yeah. So the organizer says... So we want you actually, you know, there Thursday night. We'd like you to kind of open things up. And I said, I'm not popular with your crowd. And and he said, I know, but that's, you know, that's that's kind of the thing. We're trying to get people to open their minds.
Why do you say yes to this?
I don't know why.
I don't understand it.
Because I go into these things thinking that, You know, you're going to make a difference. Change one person. Just change one person and open their mind.
Good luck.
I know.
Well, I see so, you changed two people to not go to this festival.
Yeah, that's right.
So congratulations. It's worked.
You changed two minds.
Congratulations.
That's nice.
So anyway, so while you two are clowning around, I'll lose 80 pounds of sweat.
I don't know how you do it. I really don't. There's no way I would say yes to that.
Well, he says to me, he says, you know what, we want you to talk about. The first session.
Oh, this is that conversation? Because I heard this conversation the other day, and he wants you to talk about God?
Yeah.
Yeah. And I said, at an atheist convention, basically, in Nantucket?
No, it's not an atheist convention, but it's not exactly a conservative convention.
Yeah, I mean, and are they religious?
I don't know. I have no idea. And wow. I said, oh, so you could take the guy that everybody wants to put into a cage, and you want him to just stand up on stage in his first introduction and just say, Jesus, that's going to make me wildly popular.
No, wow. I mean, we had Tom Scott on the show. Yeah, yeah. He's the guy, he founded Nantucket Nectars, one of the guys that founded that.
Yeah.
This is his Nantucket project, which is a really cool thing. He's a good guy. We talked to him. He's very open to different viewpoints.
And he's conservative. And
oh, is he?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, wow. He is.
And isn't he featured in Friction or one of the books we read, right?
I'm not sure.
The example of his company is cited in there.
Right, because he started the company by bringing peach juice to different boats in the harbor. And
yeah, that's right. It is. It's in Friction.
Yeah, and it grew into an incredible company, which I wanted to ask him when he was here. Is like, I mean, peach juice? Like, I like peach juice, but bringing peach juice to boats, that's how you built this
thing? That's how he built it. And then he sold it to Cranberry or Cranapple or for like $250 million.
Ocean Spray.
Cranapple. That's what I'm thinking.
Sold it to the Cranberries.
No, it was Cadbury. That's what you're thinking. It was Cadbury Schweppes.
It was Cadbury Schweppes, yes.
And it was hundreds of millions, right?
Yeah.
It was $250 million.
Yeah, I don't think they've ever announced how much it was, but it was a lot.
No, he told us the story. He got a call, and they said, hey, you know, we kind of want to talk to you about potentially buying it. So he, in preparation for the call, had no idea how much his company was worth and just thought, and he did some math and he tried to figure out, okay, this is about what they're going to offer me. When they got the call, they offered him 10 times the amount he had planned.
I mean,
so
how great would that be?
Can you imagine?
Oh, wow.
You take
so
that
now
deal.
That's, I mean, you got to put yourself in his shoes. Now he's just looking for fun. Now he's like, who should be in a room?
Who could I have who crucified could I, here on
Who could
Nantucket
I bring
Island?
Into a room and just watch what happens? Hillary Clinton coming up in just a second. It's the dead of the night, and you're abruptly woken by the sound of glass shattering. Somebody in your house? You reach over, you unlock your nightstand safe, your hand closes around your handgun, its weight feels familiar in your hand because you've done it a million times. You've been there before, but this time, it's real. Your training is kicking in, and the rest of what happens is a blur. You have to protect your family from an intruder who intended to cause them harm or worse. I don't care if the guy is dead or wounded, but you drew a gun, and if you fired it especially, you can breathe a sigh of relief for a second. The family is shaken. But when police arrive, they're not going to immediately hail you as a hero. In fact, you're probably going to be forcefully questioned and arrested, especially depending on where you're from in the country. Keeping your family safe does not stop when the smoke clears. Knowing what you need to say and what you shouldn't say when the police arrive is the single most important thing that you can discover today that would mean the difference between you walking away being free and going home to your family and a jail cell. There is an organization now that is protecting the protectors, and that is the USCCA. Go to protectanddefend.com and claim your copy of the USCCA's free guide that will uncover the six things you didn't know would happen when the police arrive. That's protectanddefend.com, protectanddefend.com.
Glenn Beck.
There is a mighty wind blowing. And it is Hillary Clinton's new book called What Happened? And she's been trying to figure it out. And as The Blaze reported yesterday, there's I think it's literally 15 things that she has blamed the election on, her loss of the election. But Hillary Clinton is joining us here in studio now.
Thank you. I didn't want to name everyone who was at fault when they asked me for the list.
But you are taking personal responsibility.
I'm here to read some excerpts from my All right.
So it's out now, and here's some excerpts from the book. What happened as read by Hillary Clinton?
For the record, it hurts to be torn apart. It may seem like it doesn't bother me to be called terrible names or have my looks mocked viciously, but it does.
Who would do that?
We wouldn't do that.
I'm used to it. I've grown what Eleanor Roosevelt said women in politics need, a skin as thick as rhinoceros hide.
I'll bet yours is. Yours seems to be.
Plus.
So, I mean, it looks like rhinoceros hide.
I've always had a healthy self-esteem, thanks to, no doubt to my parents, who never once told me that I had to worry about being prettier or thinner. And yet, it hurts to be torn apart. It didn't start with running for office when I got glasses in the fourth grade, way smaller than the Coke bottle ones I wore later in life.
Tome, isn't it?
I don't know why I expected it to be this celebration. I mean,
it's so sad. It started when I got glasses, sort of Coke glasses when I was in fourth grade. So I've always hated the Coke brothers. It reminded me of those glasses I had.
In junior high, a few unkind schoolmates noticed the lack of ankles on my sturdy legs. And
no, this is not in the book.
You're making this up.
I don't make things up in my book. This is my latest book.
Wait, read that again.
No, read it again.
This is really in there, Hillary?
Let me see it.
In junior high, a few unkind schoolmates noticed.
I want a producer in here right now. Producing this segment? I want a verification.
Do you mind? I'm trying to read excerpts from my book.
All right. Let's hear it.
Is it really?
It really is in there.
A few unkind schoolmates noticed the lack of ankles on my sturdy legs.
This is really in there.
That is unbelievable.
And did their best to embarrass me.
She had cankles in grade school?
I talked to my mom about that once.
Is that what we're learning
here?
And
she told me to ignore it, to rise above it, and to be better. That advice prepared me well for the barrage of insults later on, Pat.
Oh, wow. That was...
Wow, you were called out by Hillary. Yeah,
and you know my name? That's impressive. I feel a little bit better now.
Yeah, wow.
Do you have more, Jeffy? I mean, Hillary?
If you're not watching this on TV, you are missing 90% of the comedy here.
Because Hillary, I will say, looks better than normal.
So lighting. Lowry is amazing with lighting.
Oh, okay.
And anyway, go ahead.
Thank you. I had my own famed tearful moment just before the New Hampshire primary in 2008. I didn't even cry, not really. I was talking about how tough running for office could be, because it can be very tough. And my eyes glistened for a moment. And
I, you know what? I have to tell you, I
it
want
sounds
to
like
hear
she actually wrote it, though, doesn't it?
Yeah,
this isn't a ghostwriter. This isn't somebody with actual writing skill. She actually wrote this.
She wrote it. No way.
It sounds like it. It's bad.
It's really bad.
It's really bad.
It became a big news story in America, and it will no doubt merit a line in my obituary someday. Interestingly, many would say
that
my tears turned out to be a good thing for me. Dozens, if not hundreds, of pundits have commented about that moment, humanized me. Maybe that's true. If so, I'm both fine with that and a little beleaguered at the reminder that yet again, I, a human, required humanizing.
She is awful.
Look, we bought the book so you didn't have to.
So you're not laughing at my life.
No. Can we have you in again later this week? Because this is just, this is amazing. This is amazing.
I mean, there are some special parts that I would like to share.
Maybe we'll have you in. Pat Gray is up next on the network.